Episode 44 with Rose Hamid.
Where meditation meets daily life, this is the Meditation Freedom Podcast.
Welcome to the Meditation Freedom Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. My name is Seeker Rode, and this podcast is a podcast all about meditation, mindfulness, and wisdom tradition practices. And today's episode is an interview with Rose Hamid, who is from a different tradition than I've previously talked about in this podcast. Rose Hamid is a Muslim American of Palestinian and Latin descent. She was born in Buffalo, New York, and she grew up in a Catholic tradition, but then chose to convert to Islam when she started her family. She's also been a flight attendant since 1985. Rose has been the co-founder and president of the Muslim Women of the Carolinas. She is a frequent speaker about topics such as Islam and the role of women in Islam, and is also a guest columnist for the Charlotte Observer, where she writes monthly columns. And after the attacks in Paris, Donald Trump proposed the establishment of a database to put all Muslims in the country in that database. And then even later, he called for a complete shutdown of all Muslims entering the United States until they could figure out what's going on. Rose Hamid felt that she wanted to protest that, and so she went to a Trump rally, and she wanted to give Trump fans an opportunity to meet a Muslim. If you saw the story in the news, she was then escorted out, and it created quite a media frenzy. So when I saw her pictures in the news of her standing with a t-shirt saying, Salam, I come in peace, and then her big smile, I thought, wow, that's really interesting. I could tell that she was a practitioner of her faith. I was very curious to get to know her a little bit better. In the show notes for this interview, I'm going to add a couple of links, including a link to a Center for American Progress report on the Islamophobia Network's efforts to manufacture hate in America, which is a pretty large-scale effort with a lot of money behind it to create all kinds of misinformation about Islam. As you'll hear in this interview, I've read very carefully the Quran as well as the Old Testament, and I found the Quran a lot less violent than the Old Testament, and I did not see any instances in the Quran where people are being taught to do things like attack disbelievers or kill anybody or cause unnecessary suffering to animals. All those things are manufactured or taken out of context by this big network that's fueling Islamophobia, creating misinformation and fear, basically taking advantage of fear of people who might not have read the book and who are assuming that that's being taught, when it in fact is not being taught. So, and we talk about that quite a bit in this interview. But if you're interested, you can check that out. And you can also check out some of the videos that I've embedded in the show notes that were done like by CNN and some of the other networks that interviewed Rose Hamid as well, but for a much shorter period of time. So with that, let's get right into the interview with Rose Hamid. Well, thank you so much, Rose, for joining me in this podcast interview.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
I know I wanted to talk a little bit at some point about your experience with your activism experience with the Trump rally, but I like to start out my interviews with the guests, just kind of getting to know them a little bit and where they're coming from and just what kind of practice they have that helps them closer to whatever their religious or spiritual idea is. And I don't know whether you were born into your religion or whether you were adopting it at some point, but maybe you can kind of describe what or how you got to your practice, and then, you know, at what point did it start to click for you, and did you really, you know, really get into it?
My mother is from Barranquilla, Colombia, and my father is Palestinian. He went to South America in 1948 when his country was in turmoil, and there was economic development had ceased. They had an economic downfall. And so he went to South America. He met my mom, and then they came to America. When we were growing up, we grew up in the Catholic tradition. And there's kind of a long story behind that, but if we have time, we could get into it. But we grew up in the Catholic tradition. And then and I had a lot of questions about the practices and the beliefs. And there was a lot of things that I remember asking nuns about these things, and I was told I had to believe things on faith. So one of my biggest things was this concept of original sin. Mm-hmm. What I remember growing up, and you know, whether that's how it was taught or not, but it's how I absorbed it, was that Adam and Eve had, or that Eve in particular, had tempted Adam, and they ate from the forbidden fruit, and they sinned against God. And that was the break between God and humanity. And therefore, people couldn't have a direct connection with God. Mm-hmm. So that's how I understood it. And then what I saw that kind of in practice was that I would have to talk to the priest, who would talk to Mary, who would talk to Jesus, who would talk to God for me, because I was not worthy of this connection with God.
So middle persons.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I felt from an early age that was not fair. So we kind of plod along with our going to church and stuff until right before confirmation, which was when we were about 12 or 13. And my father, by that time, had started to learn about his own faith. He was Muslim, but he really wasn't practicing growing up. So when he started to realize how different Christianity and at least the church was compared to what he was used to growing up, because he grew up in Palestine, where Jews and Christians and Muslims lived amongst each other, and they were considered people of the book from the Muslim perspective. So I don't think he really realized how different the teachings were until he came to America and saw how different the teachings were, and until he started to really learn his own faith. So he was trying to teach us our more about Islam, but we just really didn't have an interest in it. And he wanted us to wait until we were older to become confirmed, which made sense to me at 13. Mm-hmm. So, there was a lot of things I didn't believe anyway, so it wasn't difficult for me to leave the church at that time. So I really didn't practice anything. I believed in God. We had a strong belief in a higher power, but I just didn't, it seemed to me from what I experienced that religion was being used to divide people, and I just really didn't have a desire to join a particular religion until after my husband and I got married and we started a family. And my husband and I didn't really talk much about religion. He's Palestinian. So there was an assumption that there was some Muslimness going on, but we really didn't talk much about it. When I started my family, I realized I was going to have to teach them something. And I started to learn about Islam, and it just answered a lot of the questions I had growing up. So, the biggest question was, or the biggest aha moment was the idea in the Islamic tradition of the story of Adam and Eve. In the Islamic tradition, the two of them disobeyed God. It doesn't make Eve more culpable than Adam. Mm-hmm. It says the two of them disobeyed God. And when they realized what they had done, they asked for forgiveness and God forgave them. So that there was never a break between God and humanity. There was always a connection. Suffer the consequences of their actions, but they were still connected to God. And that to me was monumental, to have this ability to connect to God. So that's my big journey.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Were there other questions that were answered as well?
Well, I remember from what I remember, and keep in mind, this is what I remember, and I don't want to make the Catholic faith sound bad. I'm just telling my personal experience.
Sure, sure. Everybody has their own experiences, yeah.
So what I remember was it seemed like God was always angry.
The Old Testament God, for sure, yeah. I grew up a Catholic as well, yeah.
Even in the Catholic tradition, I felt like, and I think it stems from that concept of original sin, where you feel like you're just not worthy and you're not good enough. Kind of thing. So I remember in Islamic, there's a couple things in Islamic teachings that really drew me. And one of them was this idea that God is not just your judge. He is your attorney and your character witness, and he's your supporting friend who's going to be there to help you during the judgment. So that seeing God in that perspective was very comforting. Also, the concept of there's a saying that if you turn towards God, he comes running towards you. And that idea of a God who wants us to come to him was a very, that felt more like the connection that I had been searching for.
Mm-hmm. And from my own reading of the Quran, and as compared to my reading of the Old Testament, it seems like the God is described as much more compassionate and forgiving.
Right. He's merciful, the most kind. And that's repeated time and time again. And as Muslims pray, we pray five times a day. And the Fatiha, which is the opening of the Quran, we repeat it five times a day, three or four times within each prayer. So we're constantly saying that in the name of God, the most merciful, the most kind, praises is due to God, the cherisher and sustainer of the universe. Most gracious, the most merciful, master of the day of judgment. You alone we worship and you alone we ask for help. Guide us along the straight path, the path of those whom you have favored, not the path of those who've earned your anger or who've gone astray. Amen. So that's something that it's the Fatiha. And we say it in Arabic, usually when we pray. So those words, you know, the most gracious, the most merciful, the most kind, those are things that, contrary to what people think, that's how we see God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And was there a particular transformative moment or like a moment of grace too that you can recall in your practice, in your journey?
I don't know if I would call it a moment of grace. I would just the understanding of the story of Adam and Eve was my big aha moment. It's like realizing that if God was willing to forgive Adam and Eve, then how should we as humans treat other people as well, as far as being forgiving beings? Mm-hmm. So that to me, just my shift in the way that I saw God and the relationship that I had with God was really the most transformative thing.
Yeah. You mentioned the five times a day of prayer. I know that's one thing that I think is a very good practice too. My practice is more in Zen Buddhist, but the idea is similar that if you only go to church once a week, it's pretty hard to be mindful of your practice if you only go once a week. But what I like about Islam too is that there's a constant reminder by doing that five times a day, and that makes you closer and more intimate with your spiritual connection than if you were just going once a week.
Mm-hmm. And I know that Christians with any faith tradition, there's a range of people.
There's a big range.
So I know that there's people who pray daily and who are Christians who are more spiritual daily and try to make connections with God throughout the day. So I know it's not. And then there's the folks who just go once a week. And then there's what a friend of mine referred to as the priesters, the people who show up for Christmas and Easter.
Right.
So there's a range. And the same is true with Islamic faith. There's people who are very diligent about their prayer. There's people who not so much. And so there's a range.
Wide range. And it's the same thing in Buddhism as well. There's a lot of people who pay lip service to it, or they wear the clothes and so forth. And actually, and I was going to talk about that later, but to me, to some extent, the people that are taking the narrative of Islam and they're actually terrorists, it seems like they're not really, they didn't read the whole book at all, because they're not doing anything that's being said, and they're very judgmental. They go and kill people, and that's like being the judge and executioner, and that shouldn't be their job at all, based on what I've been reading in the book.
You probably read more than they have.
I believe it.
I think that these folks who are in power in many places in the so-called Muslim world are not following Islamic doctrine. When I hear about things that people have done, I can't fathom that those people really have read the Quran or read the whole Quran. They might have read like, you know, little snippets that somebody handed them and told them this is what it says.
Right.
But unfortunately, I think that humanity is kind of like that. I mean, we, you know, if you get a new, let's just say you get a new cell phone and you know, you got all these instructions for how to use it, but you tend to just usually go, hey, 12-year-old kid, how do I use this thing?
Just show me how to dial. Right.
Yeah. Just show me the basics that I need to know just to get along. So right. Then, and that's what people do. They'd rather just, you know, they want to read the whole instruction manual. They're just wanting to get the quick, you know, FAQs and, you know, let me just turn it on and get it to work and work for me in whichever way I want it to work without really reading or understanding the full depth of what can be done with it. I mean, imagine what our cell phones could probably do, a whole lot that we know can do with them. But so I meant, so I just take that analogy into how people understand their faith. It's just a lot of times just easier to listen to whoever has the microphone and it's like, oh yeah, okay, well, you know, I've done my studying and people don't get into the depths of it.
Yeah, that's very expedient and not doing the work themselves, but kind of outsourcing it to, like you said, whoever has the loudest horn. Yeah.
Yeah.
And another big part that I noticed, and that's for me something that I see in the Old Testament as well, although it required me to have fresh eyes in reading it, is the gratitude part and how important that is, because as humans we have such a tendency to take things for granted so quickly. One of the advantages, because spiritual and religious practices get such a bad rap, but there are so many good things as part of it that would make humanity as a whole be much more in a healthy state of mind. Like for example, the gratitude. What's your take on gratitude in your practice? What role does it play?
Well, part of the five daily prayers, there's some parts that are structured, and there's certain specific things that you say and do. And then other parts you could read different chapters or verses from the Quran. And some people have memorized certain verses that they connect to or they're, you know, So people read those depending on how they feel. And a lot of them have to do with gratitude. But when you're in submission, when you're praying and your forehead is on the floor, you're in a state of gratitude and thanking God for what he has provided. So it's difficult to pray five times a day without having an element of gratitude in that. So there's a constant gratitude. There's an expression where Muslims say Alhamdulillah, which means all praise is due to God. And that's like if somebody, you know, somebody says, oh, congratulations for whatever, you say Alhamdulillah, or, you know, you did a great job with that, you know, Alhamdulillah. It's, you know, all praise is due to God. And that to me is this gratefulness that God has bestowed on us. You know, there's even a sense of if something bad happens, it's an expiation for sins. So there's even a gratitude for that. You know, it's like, thank you for providing me this opportunity to expunge a sin. So there's a constant sense of gratitude for what has been given, even if it's a bad thing. There's a sense of gratitude for having the opportunity to get through that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's constant gratitude.
And do you find also, since you came to this religion, that, and I've seen that with other folks too, if you come to a religion and you weren't born into it, you're not taking it as much for granted as likely as if you were born into it, or is that, do you not find that as much the case?
Oh, definitely true. I think that when people learn their faith through osmosis, you know, through however, you know, they learn it because that's what everybody else is, and that's, you know, that's kind of what everybody's doing, then people don't have the sense to go in depth and learn it. Karen Armstrong is a writer of religious books. She's British. Mm-hmm. And she can't find a whole lot of market in England for her books. She finds more in America. Mm-hmm. And there's because America is actually more It was written in a book by Diane Eck is her name, the New Religious America, I think is what the book was called. But in it, she talks about how, because America has competing religions, they almost have to really step up their game, like advertise and bring people in.
Right.
And it's like a competition to get people in. So there's more rhetoric, there's more talking about, people are conversing about it more. Whereas if you're in a country where everybody's, there's a state religion and everybody's the same religion, and like a lot of European countries are, there is no discourse. There's no opportunity to talk about or to investigate or ask questions or to question ourselves or to search or to seek. Where in America, we have those opportunities because of the competition of all these different religions. At least that's Diana Eck is for me. That's yeah. what she wrote in her book. Actually, I think it was an observation from a Frenchman who'd come to America and observed in the 1800s, he'd observed this aspect of this competing for folks to come to their church. And so that actually ramped up religious dialogue in America than it did in other countries where everybody was in theory the same faith.
Yeah, that's interesting. It has a chance to be refreshed and get a fresh chance to be seen again.
Yeah. And it's not just, it also goes deeper. You know, we, in America, I think we go deeper in our faith. Mm-hmm. I know that people, a lot of Muslims who come from so-called Muslim countries and come to America, once they come to America and they realize that they're a minority religion and they have to now teach their children something, then they find themselves becoming more adherent to their faith here in America than they did back home, wherever back home was.
Interesting.
Because back home, everybody's like just learning it through osmosis. Everybody's just doing the same thing, and you're just kind of following along and doing what everybody else does because that's just how everybody does it. But in America, you have to really absorb it, and you have to really learn it in order to live it, because it's not just all around you. You have to learn. Actually, I heard a Jewish woman say the same thing. She'd grown up in Israel, and she said that when she never kept kosher. She didn't keep kosher. She didn't go to she didn't read the Torah. She wasn't adherent to her faith until she came to America, and she was a minority, and she realized that she was going to have to, you know, then she was the Jewish person, and she had to be the one who knew how to be Jewish.
Right.
So she learned more about Judaism in America than she did in Israel. And the same is true of, I think, most people come from a place where the majority of folks are the same faith.
Yeah, and I've seen the same thing with Buddhism as well, where it kind of languishes and goes into autopilot in some of the older countries. And then here in America, it's really much stronger. And like you said, much more seeking and questioning and being inquisitive about it. What about the fasting? What does that teach? Because I know we had a friend who did that, and it was also another kind of humbling and gratitude type practice. What is that? What's your relationship to that?
What's amazing about Ramadan, and it's funny because Ramadan is like, I have so much willpower during Ramadan. When I'm on a diet, not so much.
Huh.
You know, it's just like, oh, I could have this piece of pie. You know, it's not that big a deal. So I'll diet tomorrow.
Right.
So not as much willpower. But when you're fasting, you have this amazing amount of willpower and ability to do things that people think you just wouldn't be able to. I remember when my kids were young, they looked forward to Ramadan. Part of it is the social experience as well. And I think it has to do with kind of like what your environment is. We've been really blessed to live in a community where there's a lot of Muslims, and we get together a lot during Ramadan. So there's this sense of community, of coming together. And, so we look forward to Ramadan. You know, the kids, when they were young, they looked forward to Ramadan. And the concept of fasting, like they kind of liked, they all started when they were in second grade. My daughter started when she was in second grade because she had a Muslim classmate. And I think she was in the same class with her. So the two of them, and they would love to go to the library instead of going to lunch, into the lunchroom. So that was, to them, it was a big treat. My boys, not so much. They stayed in the cafeteria because to them, they said, well, then they didn't have to waste time standing in line. They could just start talking with their friends right away. So it was kind of like a badge of honor to be able to tell people that they were fast. And they started that young. And then there's a sense of community that comes around during that time. And that's to kind of like the outside part. And of course, the inside part is this, this deep desire to connect with God. I usually end up taking vacation days during Ramadan. So I try to become more, read more and just be introspective and just try to take all of it in as much as I
can. Yeah, that sounds like a retreat.
Yeah. And trying really hard, although it's hard to combat this. People end up spending a whole lot of time cooking during Ramadan because they're like making everybody's favorite foods during Ramadan. And it's like having Thanksgiving every night for a month. So the battle is to not allow yourself to do that, to find a balance where you're making it festive and you're making more things to make, it's kind of like you want to make it festive. You want to make it a tradition that people look forward to, that have people have fun, your kids in particular have fond memories. So there's that element to it of trying to make it festive as well as spiritual.
So it's not too serious. And do you think part of it is easier because you're doing it with a whole group together,
so if you were to have to do it
alone, that would be harder.
Here's the thing is there's this, if you're menstruating during Ramadan, you're not required to fast. But you make up those days. Making up those days after Ramadan is really hard because you're doing it by yourself.
Right.
Or there's a recommendation of fasting 6 days, the month after Ramadan. Fasting those 6 days where it's random and not everybody's also fasting at the same time is just really hard, even though you just finished a whole month of fasting. So definitely there's this whole sense of community and the whole world is fasting at the same time. So there is definitely that sense of connectivity that the month of Ramadan brings with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I believe it. The other thing I wanted to ask you is, it talks a lot about, in the Quran, about being mindful of God. And that's one of the reasons why I could kind of work this into my podcast too, because mindfulness is one of the things that's very important in some of the other spiritual traditions. How do you see mindfulness of God? Do you see that as maybe you can explain how you practice that?
I think when I see a tree, I'm just enamored by trees, and I think about what goes into a tree and how God has provided us with this thing that we could benefit from in so many different ways, all different kinds of trees. So, just the being mindful of the things that God has created. Like when you look at the sky and you look at the sunset, if you look at the sunrise, you look at the moon and you look at the stars, and all of that is like mindfulness of God created these things for us, created these things for us to help us. And so there's many, many verses in the Quran that talk about, what God has created for us. I'm constantly mindful of the things, even the things that I have. When I get in my car and my car starts, being mindful that there's people out there who don't have a car. There's people who depend on public transportation, and how blessed I am to have a car that works. Although this isn't so much true anymore because my kids took the bus. But when I'd see people like standing waiting for the bus, I was like, man, I'm so lucky that I have a car and I don't have to wait for the bus. But then my kids were taking the city bus to college. So it's not necessarily just the people who are unfortunate. It's people who are making that decision. So it's kind of like changing.
Right.
But when I just think about everything that I have. We have heat. I have water. I have power. So there's always constant mindfulness, and then of course there's the prayers that always bring you back to it. But
and so the prayers help you with being more mindful then too.
Definitely.
Yeah,
definitely. Kind of went without saying, but of course the gratefulness and the mindfulness is right there. It's this thing that's, I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm doing this because you've asked me to. It's not for God. I'm not doing this. God didn't ask us to do this because he needs our prayers. He asked us to do this because we need our prayers. Mm-hmm. It's not for him.
Right, right. And what's your take on this, this life versus the hereafter? Is there like a, how does it affect your life today to look at the here or to look forward to the hereafter? Does that affect it at all? Do you see that or?
Muslims believe in the concept of heaven and hell. So we know that this life is a test and that how we comport ourselves, how faithful we are, how we adhere to the guidance that God has provided us is going to determine our afterlife. So this life is very short, the hereafter that we're aiming for. So it's also a constant that we should always be thinking about how the actions that we take today are going to affect the hereafter. There's a belief that, every bug that you killed unjustly will speak against you on the day of judgment, so everything that you've done will be a witness to what you've done. Your hands, if you struck people will testify against you on the day of judgment, saying that this hand was used to strike people or to beat people. So we are very mindful of, at least we should be, we're supposed to be mindful of how we live our life and knowing that we will be held accountable for how we live our life.
Yeah, so being aware of the consequences of one's actions, sounds like.
Definitely. Yeah. We have the concept of free will, and so we are making choices in everything that we do every day.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Yeah, very conscious choices.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes not so conscious.
Sometimes
we're not being so conscious. It's what we aspire to, I should say. Aspire to recognize. Right, to realize everything we do as consequences.
Right, right. I know the Quran talks about disbelievers a lot, and that's one of the things that it seems like some of the people in America have latched onto. Anyway, my interpretation of that is that they're afraid of that Muslims see disbelievers as something bad or that's trouble. But again, from my reading in the Quran, that's not something that Muslims have to deal with so much as that's something that's God's business. And so, and it's not for anybody to judge that. At least that's my thinking, my understanding of it. What's your understanding of it?
That's exactly right. There's a group of people in America, these Islamophobic group of people who, it's a network of very specific people, a small group of people who are funded by specific funds, specific groups that are funding these people. They are working hard at presenting misinformation about Islam and Muslims. Now, Muslims themselves are not, in other countries are not doing us a favor either because they're doing some stupid stuff also.
Yeah.
But the fact that there's this group in the U.S. that is constantly churning all this misinformation and presenting it in a way that people believe it, especially people in power believe it. They have the ear of people in power. And it's quite frightening to hear this whole thing of how, Muslims are required to kill non-Muslims. And that's not what the Quran said.
Yeah, I didn't read that anywhere.
Yeah, if you look at the history of, if you look at the history of how Islam spread, if you look at the actual history as opposed to the abridged or tainted history that some present, Islam was not spread by the sword. There was different reasons why people became Muslim around the world. It was not a forced conversion kind of thing. And they didn't kill people who were not Muslims. There was battles that were had, but it wasn't just to say, we're going to kill everybody who's not a Muslim. That's just not how it was, and it's not in our doctrine. It's not what we're taught, where there's this concept of the people of the book, where the people who received the messages before, which are Christians and Jews, Sabians, and some other big traditions that I can't quite remember the names of right now, but they, so there's supposed to be a respect for the people of the book. And there's, you know, ways to speak to the people of the book. And there's constantly talking about, you know, how to treat your neighbor, the believer, the unbeliever, the neighbor who's near, the neighbor who's far. So there's a lot of instruction and guidance on how to deal with people who are not Muslim. Even in the life of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, you could see the way that he treated people who were not Muslim. And there was a treaty that was signed early on when he went to Medina, when he migrated from Mecca to Medina, that has outlines how to treat people who are not Muslim. Mm-hmm. And pretty much it says that those folks can administer their law according to their faith tradition. And there was, you know, rights and responsibilities for the state and for the people who are not Muslim and for the people who are Muslim. And so there was from the very beginning a framework set on how to interact with people who are not Muslim and say that you had to kill everybody who wasn't Muslim. But that story gets perpetuated, especially about the Islamophobic network.
Right. In a way, and that's part of what this is too, is taking back that narrative that they've kind of almost hijacked and turned it into their own propaganda for less peaceful reasons.
Definitely. Yes. And it's, you know, it's all like whenever people hear about religious wars around the world, it's not about religion. It is not about religion. It's always, 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 every single so-called religious conflict in the world was not about religion. It was about the haves against the have-nots, mm-hmm. the people in power wanting to maintain that power, the people wanting the wealth or wanting the resources or wanting to take ownership of a place or a oil field or whatever it is. You know, mm-hmm. It's not, the religious battles are not based on religion. It's based on political, socioeconomic struggles that people are having. That just happens to be that those folks are that religion and these folks are this religion. And so that's, even if you look at the issues in Ireland, it really wasn't about religion.
Right. It's just easier to pit people against each other if you use religion.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Exactly. That's a great little baiting, hook to get people, you know, demonizing the other, whoever the other is.
Right, and creating another, and I think that, and that's what brings me to your Trump experience, and because I found that a very creative way that you took to show your face, and that you're just a human being, because this rhetoric and this constant repetition and mischaracterization, it just takes the human face out of it, and that's how it becomes dangerous, in my opinion, is when they take the human face out of it, and it just they're creating something that's not really true. So yeah, that was a interesting experience.
And I have to say, it wasn't my idea. The man standing next to me in the pictures, his name is Marty Rosenbluth. He and I had just met him that night. He's a friend of a friend of mine who I'd gone with. I knew two of these people. These folks have been, they're real, I guess soldiers is the word I could describe, although that has a negative connotation. But they do work around social justice with, immigration rights, Black Lives Matter, voting rights, anti-hate, anti-Islamophobia. This group of folks have been very diligent about doing a lot of work on the ground where they're trying to educate people. My one friend, Edie Garwood, she works with Amnesty International. I think a lot of the other folks in that group also are connected with Amnesty International too, but they do a lot of that kind of work. And it was, their idea. They have this campaign called Go Yellow Against Hate. And that Marty, the man next to me, who was, as a Jewish man, when he heard this concept of having, I think the final straw for him was when Trump was saying that Muslims should have special IDs and that they should be tracked in a database. For him as a Jewish man, it really struck a chord with him that was very disturbing. So when he had seen this yellow star, he'd seen it in a protester in England, I think somewhere. So he recreated that with the 8 points, and he purposely made it 8 points and not the Star of David because he didn't want to,
bring up the Holocaust or?
Well, he wanted people to be reminded of it, but he didn't want to, I'm losing the word, I can't, to appropriate it, to, inappropriately. Mm-hmm. That means so much for so many people and is so painful for so many people. But it was painful for him to see how things were starting down that slippery slope that he recognizes, was kind of where things started in the Jewish people.
Right.
So it was important to him. So it was their idea to do the stand, to stand silently. They had done that at the Aiken rally in South Carolina the month before. They had stood silently. So it wasn't my idea. I can't take credit for that. That's something that they did. So it was just.
But you were the only Muslim in the standing?
The group of people that were there were all different faith traditions. There was Marty, who was Jewish. I don't know if there's any other Jewish people in the group. There was Christians. There were non-Christians. And then Jabril Huff, who's the man who was shouting, he was off to the other side. He shouted, when Trump started saying that we've got a problem. Jabril yelled, Islam is not the problem. And so he's the one that you see in the video being dragged away. He's wearing a white kufi and he's being dragged away. Yeah. So that was his way of protesting. And we talked about it in advance, and I told him we decided that it was not a good idea for me to stand near him, because he knew that in Aiken, the actual crowd had attacked him before the security guards got to him. So yeah. I didn't plan to say anything. I just wanted to stand silently like they had done before.
Yeah, yeah.
So I can't take credit for it.
Yeah, but it was still a risk then a little bit. I mean, if you stood with the wrong people, it could have been a problem. Mm-hmm. The other thing you also said, if we all said hello with a smile, just start an encounter that way, that can change the world. And I think in a way, that's one of the things you, just by your silence and smile, that spoke volumes. And did you find that helped people see you more human as a result of that?
Definitely. Actually, when I was standing in line, we purposely split up. We were supposed to all come together, but then traffic and stuff got in the way. So we ended up in different parts of the line. I was standing in line by myself, and there was a group of people in front of me. They were all together, and a group of people behind me that were all together. So I didn't really have any interaction there, but I was actually really kind of worried that they wouldn't let me in. So I was trying to keep very low profile there and not say anything, and just kind of hopefully. I was concerned they wouldn't let me in. Mm-hmm. So, but they're in line ahead of me, ahead of this family that was there, that was chatting and everything. There was a woman who'd caught my eye, and then, we kind of looked at each other. And as we got closer to the front, as the doors opened and we were letting in, she came over to me and she said, "Oh, I'm so glad to see you here." And then there was another woman with her who said that I didn't look scary or that I looked nice. Right. Or something along those lines, like that she, I looked friendly, or I looked like I was a nice person, or something. And of course, I was wearing the shirt that said "Salam, I come in peace," and I did that on purpose. I wanted people to, I wanted to wear something that, because I imagined maybe I'd get a picture taken. I did not anticipate this media right. coverage at all. So I thought if I have one opportunity for somebody to take a picture of me, I want to say something with what I was wearing. So my son, who owns a t-shirt printing business, and it's coolmuslimshirts.com. That's one of his designs. So that's what I wore. And people are saying, "Oh, you chose that color on purpose. Look at you standing out like that." I'm like, the choices were black, gray, white, or that blue color that he happened to have in the store. So that's the color I chose. And I just happened to have a headpiece that matched it when I got home. It's like, it was just meant to be.
Perfect. Right.
So
then after this media frenzy, did you notice anything that surprised you as well as in the way you were treated?
You mean at the rally?
Like afterwards when you started getting calls from people or social media started blowing up a little bit about it. And
my son was sending me stuff. Actually, we had all met at a restaurant. After we were all escorted out, because Marty and I were, well, Jabril was escorted out first. He was the one who shouted. And then they came over and told Marty and me to leave. And then we were already out the door. And then a few minutes later, they came back and got the rest of the folks who had the yellow stars on. So they got them and led them out as well. And they were pretty aggressive with them. So, we decided to meet at a restaurant. So we're sitting at the restaurant. My son is sending me texts saying, you are all over the place. What had happened was there was a reporter from CNN, Jeremy Diamond, who before the rally started, when I arrived, shortly after I arrived and sat down, he came over and talked to me, because I purposely sat behind Trump because I knew the cameras would be across. Right. That was intentional. It was going to be a protest. It was going to be a silent protest, but you know, people were kind of criticizing. It's like, you did that on purpose. And I'm like, well, yeah, rule number one.
Protester.
You're
right.
Going to protest, get in front of the camera. So yeah. So we purposely sat there. And, so anyhow, Jeremy came over and he spoke to me before the rally started. So as we were being escorted out, after we got out, he called and he got my number. So he called right away and he was asking me what had happened. And so I think, before we even got to the restaurant, Anderson Cooper had tweeted about it and said that a Muslim woman was just escorted out of the Trump Tower, out of a Trump rally, for no apparent reason. So I think that was the first tweet that I saw. And then, my niece, who's she's a social media whiz. She's a makeup artist. And she was sending me stuff that people were saying, and it was mostly positive, but it was also like people, I don't know.
Well, and that's the thing about
the computer.
Right, exactly. Behind the computer creates this invisibility, which makes it easier to.
And it's the same as the people on the, as the crowd, as the mob mentality. I've got a friend who's studying the genocide and how, you know, a society can allow that. And, you know, what is it that makes a society permit something like that? And it's all kind of these same things that are kind of tied together when you fall into like this, you know, behind the computer mentality is very similar to the crowd mentality where you don't have, you're not taking like personal responsibility for how you're. So it's an other entity.
Yeah. So it becomes a mob entity and the individual just gets dissolved in that and dissolved of individual responsibility too.
Exactly. And that's kind of what she was telling me, that it's the same kind of, behavior. When I was going up the stairs and people were yelling at me, I wasn't mad at them. I just was like, I can't believe you're behaving this way. You're a human. How could you behave this way? And I tried to make connections with the people that were talking to me and yelling at me in the hope of snapping them out of their trance that they were in, but not so much. I think they were pretty stuck in their little trance.
Yeah.
One of the bad things, negative things that's happened is that, there's this whole, and it's all tied to this Islamophobic group of folks who have labeled pretty much any organization, any Muslim organization in America, any valid Muslim organization in America as a terrorist supporting organization. So what they do is the way that this whole Islamophobic thing works is, okay, so they've labeled an organization a terrorist supporting or unindicted co-conspirator or something. So anybody who has any connection with that organization is also then labeled as a terrorist supporter.
Yeah.
So that's a dangerous thing. It's a very dangerous thing for people to be claiming, you know, to making these ridiculous claims. Because at first I was like, oh, no one's going to believe that. But the other day, a friend of mine who I work with was telling me that there's people who I know and I have known for years who are starting to believe some of that stuff.
Yeah, so that's the scary part. Yeah.
That is real. It's like, you know, you've known me for 30 years and you believe that you think that I'm a secret terrorist. Really? You really think that? It's just, it's actually really quite, it's painful because I'm thinking, what can you do? What could you do about that? You know, you can't, I don't know how to combat that. You know, it's like other than being a decent person your whole life, and then for somebody to claim that you're a terror supporter and now people believe it, it's just very disheartening that anybody would really believe that.
Yeah, yeah. And with Bush, the second Bush, that when he said, you know, if you're not with us, you're against us. And that to me, that's that whole black and white thinking. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that's what Trump is doing as well, or the organizations you're talking about.
And it's not, and actually, if you want to read more about that, there's a report called Fear Inc., Fear INC, that outlines who those people are. It's, and they put out like a shorter one called Fear Inc. 2.0. Uh-huh. And that one's more, I think that one's in 2014 or 15. The original one's, I think, 2012. But it outlines those folks who are behind all that. But the, it's as much as that negative stuff is, the amount of support that I've gotten has just been amazing. The people, I just the other day got a $100 gift certificate from a restaurant because they have a program where their employees can nominate a community person who's, you know, helping, you know, promoting the community in a positive way. And, and I got a gift certificate for $100.
That's great.
From a restaurant called Dogwood. So shout out to them. Thank you so much. And, so it's, I mean, it's that, and people send flowers and cards, just amazing, amazing support, and people saying how it's inspired them. There's the thing that really like chokes me up is that people say, my daughter wants to meet you. And it's just so heartwarming. It totally overshadows like the negative stuff, but it's just amazing to see. I just never expected anything like that, where people are saying, you know, you're a rock star. My daughter thinks you're a rock star.
Like, that's great.
That's like the best compliment. And somebody said I was a badass. I'm like, yeah, I'll take that too.
Yeah, that's great.
I'd rather be seen as that than, you know, I don't want to be seen as like, I hope I never portrayed the notion that I was a victim. I didn't feel like a victim.
Uh-uh, no.
I felt pretty in control of the situation because it was planned and I knew what I was going to do. I kind of expected the crowd to get walked out.
Right.
I really
sure.
did not expect the crowd to turn so quickly. But in retrospect, I guess I should have expected that because I saw how people had been treated. But one of the interesting things is, there was a reporter, actually he's a German reporter. His report just came out in, Der Spiegel, which is a German publication, and he's been following Trump around for a year. He's based out of Washington, and he said that at every rally, Trump supported, there's a written statement apparently because they said that every rally they say the same thing. They say, Mr. Trump supports the First Amendment almost as much as he supports the Second Amendment. Uh-huh. So you need to let that sink in a second and realize what he's saying. Then they say, this is a peaceful rally. If you want to exercise your First Amendment freedom of speech, you're free to do so outside the door. And if there's anybody who disturbs this rally, just the supporters were told to stand up and shout, chant Trump, 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 and point to whoever it is that's causing disturbance, and security would escort them out.
Oh, so they're actually being instructed. All the people that come in there, they get that instruction.
Yeah, that's what they're told. And like I said, this reporter's been following them around for a year. He said that at every rally. What I noticed the other day, though, the last time, because I heard a recording of it, and people have been posting the recording of it, that they said that they took away the almost. It's like they realized that what they were saying was so wrong, to say that Trump supports the First Amendment almost as much as supports the Second Amendment. That's just so wrong. It's so wrong. What I've discovered is media have been interviewing me. Like I remember, Al Jazeera, the Arabic station, interviewed me shortly after it happened. And they said, so Americans, really hate Muslims now. I'm like, no. No, Americans don't hate Muslims. It was just those few people. They don't represent all of America.
It's still a minority, yeah.
Yeah, but I found myself having to defend America and to these foreign, you know, foreign press and say that that's not how America is. And having to explain to them the concept of the First Amendment. Like I'd said it to one person and they said, you'll have to explain that for our audience. What is the First Amendment? And then I realized how significant it is, what the First Amendment is, because other countries don't have it. Other countries don't have freedom of speech. They don't have freedom of religion. So that's, if we're going to export anything, that's the thing we could export.
Absolutely.
But,
yeah.
But Americans don't realize how fortunate we are to have this. And I've heard people have said, well, you know, why are you protesting here? Why don't you go protest in, you know, Muslim countries and protest against all the stuff that people are doing over there? Well, people over there who try to protest end up dead. The people who are trying to fight these regimes who have taken power, if they resist, they end up dead. You know, they don't have the protections that we do here.
Right.
So, you know, it's not as easy as you think to just say, well, you know, why don't people over there just object to it? Well, it's not that easy to do that. I mean, that's where you ended up with the Arab Spring and then all these other battles that have taken place in the civil war that's going on is where people are trying to stand up. But then everything gets confused and who's the good guy and who's the bad guy. It's not as easy as we think it is.
All right. And have you been contacted by any conservative papers or stations after the event?
Not really. No, I haven't. No, I mean, I've finally put them in a database. I think I've had about 30 interviews. And they have been very supportive. You know, you're always afraid of what the media might say, or they might. There's some things that they've gotten inaccurate. Like somebody had said that I was the only one ejected. I'm like, no, I never said that. I never said I was the only one ejected. There was 8 of us that were there. We were all ejected. So you know, there's been some misinformation, but it's all been positive. I haven't had an interview with anyone who is aggressive. There's people who interviewed me. And then, of course, there's a whole lot of stuff out there that where people didn't interview. There's people who were quoting. Usually, most people, from the reports that I saw, if they didn't directly interview me, then they were just taking what the Don Lemon interview after the rally. People were just taking quotes from that. It seemed like that's what people were using.
Yeah.
And then the negative stuff. I don't know where they came up with stuff. I don't know what they were looking at, but. I've created a website to kind of archive all of those things, and I write a monthly column for the local newspaper that addresses like a lot of questions that a lot of people have, like why do women cover, you know, celebrating different holidays and how Muslims celebrate that, and just basically what it's like to live in America as a Muslim. So those columns are highlighted are. Archived there as well. So the website is www.mrsrosehamid.com.
Yeah, I'll make sure I link to that so people can follow up on that. I know a lot of people, they have that question about the head covering, the hijab. And you mentioned somewhere that you found it liberating and freeing. Maybe you can just share a little bit about what your thinking is behind that.
For me, the wearing hijab is an act of worship. So that's one aspect of it, is that I'm doing something that God has asked me to do. So it's an act of worship in that regard. But to me, it also sends a message that my value and my worth to society doesn't come from my physical attributes.
Mm-hmm.
That who I am as a person is how I behave and how well I follow the dictates of my faith and how well I do my job or how well I do whatever it is that I'm trying to do. And how I treat people. Those are the things that I should be measured by and not by my physical attributes. Mm-hmm. So that's one aspect of it. So in that regard, it's very liberating because I could pretty much put together whatever outfit I want. I got scarves that match every outfit.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like I don't have to adhere to whatever the latest fashion trends are and I could pretty much wear what I want. And it's also feels like a protection to me. I feel I feel protected. And when there's opportunity, when women are around, just when it's just women, we only have to cover it in front of men who are not family. Mm-hmm. So if, like, for example, a neighbor comes over, I'd have to cover. But if it's just my husband and my kids or my dad and my uncles, then in those situations, I don't have to cover. And also are not required to cover around women. However, I would not feel comfortable uncovering around somebody who I didn't trust. So even though it's permissible for me to uncover in front of other women, mm-hmm. Especially other Muslim women, and for Muslim women, we would uncover, but for people who are not Muslim, I would have to measure how comfortable I was around that person before I uncovered, because to me, it feels like a protection, mm-hmm. and that's to that degree.
Yeah. So that's great. Do you still do your job as an airline attendant?
Yes, I do.
And they let you cover, and that continues to be no problem, and everybody's good with that?
Yeah, everybody's good with it.
That's great.
Customers, the passengers have been, I've never had a single passenger do or say anything to me negatively. If anything, people have been like extra nice is what I've noticed. Like there might be some people who might like kind of give me a funny look, but like, huh, that's unusual. I've never seen that before. Ever, they'll like poke the other person. It's like, look at that.
Right.
So it's not like in a bad way though. It's like, it is curious.
Curious. Curiosity. Yeah. Right.
So it's not, I really haven't had anybody, and I see hundreds of people every day.
Right.
I haven't seen anybody, behave in a way that I felt was threatening or negative towards me and myself. Seeing me as a Muslim.
Yeah, that's really good to know. And what do you have, just to finish this up, what's your deepest wish kind of as a Muslim, for the future? Do you have like something you deeply wish?
I wish that people would follow their faith, whatever that faith is. Because if you look at the guidance that God has sent or the Creator has sent to whatever faith tradition there is, if people follow their faith tradition and not the leaders necessarily, but actually or who they think are leaders, but actually learn what their faith tradition says and follow those guidelines, we would have a much better world. There's nothing in these teachings that permits the way that we are treating each other in so many ways, where we treat people who are different, whatever that difference is, in a negative way. There isn't a faith tradition out there that promotes that kind of mentality.
I agree. Yeah, totally. Yeah, and that's my wish too. So that's a wonderful way to end it. Yeah, thank you so much for sharing and your generosity in sharing too.
Thank you so much.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this interview with Rose Hamid and that it gave you some new insights into why Muslims practice and what are some of the benefits of this practice. And maybe it can help inform your practice. You can find the show notes, the transcription basically, for this episode by going to meditationfreedom.com/44. And of course, feel free to make comments, or if you have any further questions based on this interview for Rose, then feel free to leave those questions on the show notes, on the comments at the bottom of the show notes. And I hope you enjoyed this, and let us know what you think. And then I'll end with a quote from Thich Nhat Hanh. He says, "In relationships, if it's true love, you can't say, that's your problem. Your problem is my problem." And personally, I think this is true for all relationships, including relationships between religions and relationships between countries. So there's some more practice for us to realize. So with that, I hope you have a wonderful rest of your week. Take care.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Meditation Freedom Podcast, where meditation meets daily life.